All right. Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And coming at you here from the center of the universe. And that, of course, is Clear Creek County, Colorado, up in the lofty United Center here. We're on the rabbit hole. And today we're wrapping up 2019. And I have a wonderful guest here. And her name is
Judy Amabile.
Judy Amabile, in the introduction, I kind of messed up. Oh, my gosh. And I'm just getting back into the routine here, Judy, so I ask forgiveness here. My brain is still kind of like on a quasi-vacation mode here.
You know? You're forgiven.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, welcome. And so Judy is, you're running to become our next legislator here from HD 16, or 13. 13, okay. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. And so let's talk about you a little bit. Now, are you a Colorado native?
No, I'm not. I moved to Colorado when I was in the eighth grade. I was 12 years old, and my mother wanted to go someplace that was more fun.
Okay.
So we moved to Aspen.
Okay. All right. And that's right in the middle of the state. That's definitely Colorado. And, you know, so you eventually you're in Boulder now.
Yeah. So in 1975, I finished high school and moved to Boulder to go to college. And I've pretty much lived there ever since.
Did you go to University of Colorado?
I went to University of Colorado. I have a degree in communications and I have a master's degree in business administration.
Oh. Very good. Okay.
Double buffalo.
A double buffalo. Okay. I'm only kind of a, you know, I did my teaching certification there and I want to say my master's in education, although I had to finish out in Denver, but still, you know, so head up there to the university. I love to walk through that campus.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's really terrific.
Yeah. There's something magical. And I guess maybe that's true for a lot, if not all, college campuses. I don't know. There's an energy there that when you come in, it just, I don't know, you feel education, you feel learning. It just moves you into another realm.
Yeah. I had a chance to meet with some graduate students there, and I was just so impressed with how smart they are, how hardworking they are. And you left the meeting feeling like, okay, we're in pretty good hands here with these young people getting poised to take over.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a whole different realm, a world they're being educated and being educated for compared to what we were in.
Yes, it's completely different.
Yeah, there's a one of the most brilliant people that I can imagine, Yuval Noah Harari, and he teaches at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he talks about the future. He's the one who wrote Sapiens and then 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And he talks about how, you know, the jobs that these young people will have, especially even when they even get to like our older age, but even in between, are not in existence yet. How do we train them for that? What would you say? You know, because I'm going to put you on the spot there, okay? And because we want to talk about the need to support higher education. What do you say about that, about educating kids, not only in, you know, K through 12, but also at the higher education level?
Yeah, well, I think in order to prepare people for jobs that we don't even know what they are, we have to be prepared to learn continuously and to have continual training and education as part of life, as part of work. And the most important thing I think we can teach young people is how to think critically. And I oftentimes, as a business owner, we would hire people who were great in accounting, for example, but hadn't really been taught to think critically. So they would look at their accounting numbers and they would say, well, I did this spreadsheet and this is what it spit out. So this is the answer. Mm-hmm. But you say, well, maybe you need to take a look at that from more of a critical view. If your spreadsheet says your sales went down and your profit went up, there might be something wrong with your spreadsheet. And you need to learn how to look at that. And that's in all realms. And I think that's one of the things that this emphasis on testing and on learning particular skills has, or facts or you know, some of this more rote stuff has taken away from the kinds of things you do with kids in order to teach them how to think critically, and taken away sort of these experiences that you need to provide young people so that they have a context for learning.
Yeah, and, you know, as a retired public school teacher, that, you know, the need is for us to support education right on from the beginning, preschool up through the university level, is like paramount to me. And I know that in your campaign, getting to know you and then looking at your site, climate change is what, you know, you have a, you know, a number of critical issues you want to address, but climate change seems to be at the top. So I'd like for you, Judy, to talk about it in two ways. One, why climate change and how? And then the, coming back to the educational piece, preparing our young people for a world that might look very different than this one, you know, simply because of natural forces.
Yeah. Well, there's three things that intersect there. One is, what are we doing to lift working people up in our state? And how does that dovetail with this climate emergency that we're in? And then how does that connect to education? If we want everybody to be a climate activist, we have people who are at the bottom of the economic scale who are worried about putting a roof over their head. They don't have time to be a climate activist. And if you tell people, we're actually going to make your life worse as we solve this climate crisis, we're going to take away the jobs in your community, we're going to take away your job, and we're not going to backfill that with anything, those people are going to resist, and resistance is going to slow us down. So if we want to address the climate crisis in the most efficient and effective way possible, we have to start by saying, what are we going to do with the people on the ground? So we have to retrain people. We have to provide economic opportunity, particularly in rural parts of our state, where people are suffering from the boom and bust cycles of the extraction industries. And that goes on all the time, not just when we're in a recession. It goes on continuously that we move these operations from community to community, and then we do nothing for the people who are left behind. Like, I grew up here in Colorado when Parachute was booming from oil shale. And within a year or two, the whole thing just went bust. And that community is still struggling to recover. And that was 30 years ago or more. So we have to stop doing that. And I think the state can play a role in incentivizing green jobs and clean tech to move to the rural parts of our state. We're going to address our climate crisis by getting rid of carbon, by converting to electric homes, electric commercial buildings, electric vehicles. And then we have to build resiliency because the climate crisis is here. So we have to make sure that we are ready to address the things that are going to happen. Drought, flood, fire, all the things that we're already experiencing are only going to get worse. And then we're going to have refugees, climate refugees, within Colorado and from all over the world. And we have to prepare for that as well. And we have to make sure that young people are learning how to do these new jobs. And we also have to have community colleges and vocational training for the new jobs that are coming. And I really believe that this can be an opportunity to make our state better and not a disaster that we're going to have to mitigate.
Yeah. You covered an excellent overview of the situation, because you can't just look at climate change itself in an isolated arena, that it has implications. You pointed out about those that impact. And so you mentioned the folks perhaps out on the Eastern Plains, what they're going through with the boom and bust cycle. You mentioned Parachute, you know, in terms of how it related to the extraction industry. And that seems to be a history of any extraction industry, anytime. And we're seeing it on a very large scale in Russia that has put all its marbles under Putin into oil. and they have an economy that's about the size of Italy's, okay, with, I don't know how many times more population, 5, 6, 10 times as many people, and certainly a massive, massive area. And so to diversify in that, and how do we do that by training? And I'm going to jump all over here myself here because you mentioned you have your background is in communications and also business. And you mentioned the climate refugees. And, I point out that the military has been addressing or concerned about climate change for well over a decade, you know, anticipating this sort of stuff there because, it starts to impact other countries. That pushes the people to move others. And there's stories, immigrants coming from Central America in large part because they're going through drought. And we associate Central America with rainforest. And they're drying out, and people can't even grow watermelons or anything like that. And so, I love how you wrap all that together. So, in some way, I'm not sure if I have a question, but I'll let you respond to my response to your response.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I do think we have failed in the past to take a big picture view and to take a long term view.
Okay.
Our business community typically looks very short term. There's a lot of short term rewards, and there aren't long term rewards. There aren't rewards for corporate leaders to be looking 20, 30 years out. And we need to change our culture around that.
How do you do that?
Well, I think there are some things that can happen with legislation at the federal level around paying people with stocks. That is actually harmful if too much of your compensation comes from short-term gains in the stock market. That causes you to behave in a way that isn't good long-term, and it isn't good for your customers, it isn't good for the community, it isn't good for the world. And so I think there are some things we can do in that regard. But I also think that locally, within Colorado, we have to address income inequality, because that is why we're having trouble solving these pernicious problems. If, like I said before, if you're at the low end of the scale, you don't have time to be a climate activist or a health advocate or any of the things that need to happen. And if you're at the high end, these things don't hurt you. And there's no benefit for you in trying to address them. You're the last person that's going to be affected by the climate crisis, whereas the people at the bottom are going to be the first people. So we have to address the income gap, and we have to lift people up and move more people into the middle class so that they can advocate for changes in these policies. And so that they can, we also have to take money out of politics so that all the politicians, especially in Washington, I don't think it's like this on a state level so much, but the politicians are being influenced by the companies that are putting them into power, and we have to stop that. That's one of the big important issues, is to take money out of politics so that the politicians actually are representing the people who they represent and not the people who pay to put them into office.
And, I think a question then, Judy, excuse me, do you believe that or sense that we're at a critical juncture, not only in American history, but in our civilization? And, one of my perspectives or philosophies as a historian also, that traditionally, at least since World War II and most of the 20th century, we've always assumed that life would keep getting better, that our kids, our next generation, will do better than we did. And then we find out that the millennials and then now the Gen Z boomers, Zoomers, I think they call themselves, are probably not going to be as wealthy and so on. And that we find that there's limits to growth.
Well, I think we measure success like we measure how well our economy is doing by saying, well, what's happening with GDP? What is there inflation? How many jobs have we created? And those things really kind of mask the conditions on the ground for real people. So yes, we have created more jobs, but we still have tons of people who aren't in the workforce. We have a housing crisis everywhere. There is a lack of affordable housing all over urban Colorado, but also all over rural Colorado. And that's not part of the calculation for inflation. So we're missing out on a huge sector of measuring how are people doing. So people out there, even if they're making a little bit more money or they hadn't been working and now they are still struggling to make ends meet because all of the expenses have gone up. Childcare is out of reach for a lot of people. Education, higher education, community college, out of reach for a lot of people. And without these, healthcare, the cost of healthcare, that's not calculated as part of the equation. So you look at how are people doing? I have three kids. They all live at home. I have a son who's a preschool teacher. There's no way he can live on his preschool teacher salary, can live independently, at least, you know, not in Boulder and not anywhere near the job that he has.
And how do we shift this thinking to educate people, to show them that we're talking here about wealth disparity? Okay, it's not just the income gap. You know, we look at the statistics and they say the unemployment rate hasn't been lower than probably World War II. But at the same time, many of these people that have these jobs are working two and three jobs. And they still can't afford to rent an apartment. How do we bring this consciousness, this awareness? Because if you're one who, I got my second home, I got a great portfolio with Fidelity or whoever it is, and I'm living the grand life. And to, you know, is it a matter of, you know, like conscious, you know, being, you know, aware of that? Is it a matter of practicality? You know, that you need everybody working. You know, if you want people to live, say, here in Clear Creek, you know, you need to patronize the restaurants and, you know, everything else here too, because people have to, you know, how do we get more people to think differently than the way it was in the past?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to talk about it more than we talk about it. I think we have to change the measurement tools so that on the news, when they're talking about how great the economy is, that they're not talking about that. That instead they're talking about how some things are better, but a lot of things are not as good. And how do we address the things that are not as good? And, you know, you talk about the stock market, and most people do not own any stock at all. They have no stock. So it doesn't change their life at all that the stock market is up, but that is the primary thing you hear on, even on NPR, oh, the Dow is up or the Dow is down, or most people just, they listen to that and they think that's good, but that's not going to help them. So I think that's part of what we have to do is start to talk about different things. And the other thing is there are some concrete things we could be doing. We need to pay people more. So I worked on the 2016 ballot measure to raise the minimum wage in Colorado from $8 an hour to $12 an hour. It hasn't even taken effect yet. The final bump up will be in 2020 when we get to $12 an hour. That, in the rear view, like at the time, it seemed like we did something really good and important. But looking back, that's not enough. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm all in on the fight for 15. Yeah. And by the time we get that done, that might not be enough either. And then I think there's some ways that we can address the affordable housing crisis by purposefully building affordable housing as opposed to just sort of letting the market do whatever it's going to do. That doesn't seem like that's really worked. Like in Denver, there's a lot of more housing being built, but it isn't driving the prices down. And then I think we have to have some rules around landlord-tenant engagement that are more fair to the tenants so that if people have a temporary setback, they don't also lose their housing. I mean, we have a massive problem with homelessness and over-incarceration. And these things are related to this income disparity or wealth disparity. And it's that problem is getting so much worse. And we're not addressing it in a way that's working. And we're also not addressing it in a way that's humane. And it's also economically a really dumb way to go about it. Putting homeless people in jail is a very costly approach. It's much cheaper to put somebody into housing than it is to incarcerate them.
It's tough to get a job when you're confined behind bars.
It's tough to get a job when you live on the street, too.
Yeah, it is.
So you really, you can't recover from addiction. You can't address your mental health problems. You can't get a job, keep a job, if you're living on the streets.
Yeah. I want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. This is The Rabbit Hole, visiting here with Judy Amabile. And we're talking about, she's a candidate to hopefully replace Casey Becker. And I've been talking about the economy in large part here, too. And I love how this conversation is going because you can't separate out the issues. So the economic issues, the homelessness and the home ownership, the ability to rent a place, and how that ties in also with climate change and health issues. You just can't do one thing, it seems.
You can't just do one thing. And I think most people know that. But you can focus on the things that you have a particular expertise in. And So I think that's important, and I think people do that at the legislature because there are so many issues. There's so much that needs to be done. And nobody is going to be an expert in every aspect.
Right.
But I do think we have to sort of have a vision of where we want to go, and that it's important to have that, a long-term vision, to look where are we going to be 20 years out, 30 years out, 40 years out, and stop focusing on the what's going to happen next year. There's some things we need to do for next year, but we have to put these things together. We have to have big goals, and then we have to have a plan to enact policies that get us there.
Yeah, shifting in consciousness to look at the long term rather than the immediate. You know, what's my portfolio going to look like next week? You need to invest in the long term, not only financially, but also in these other ways. Mentioned at the beginning of our conversation here about climate change being one of your passions here. But another one that I saw is in the health field, and that's mental health. Let's talk about that. Why is that so critical as a topic focus for you?
Well, I have a personal stake in that. One of my kids has serious mental illness, and we've spent the last 10 years trying to navigate the mental health care system here and have found it to be broken at every turn. The people who absolutely have the greatest need for services are the people who have the most trouble getting them. And it's not just that there's not enough money. That's part of it, maybe. But we don't know, the money isn't being spent effectively, it isn't being spent efficiently, and the treatment that people are getting is inhumane many times. So for the people with the most serious mental illnesses, there's a big connection with incarceration, homelessness, drug addiction, suicide. And part of the way we begin to address some of these issues is by saying, how can we actually provide the kind of services that people actually need that help people with these serious mental illnesses to recover? And the truth is, we don't treat people before they're in a crisis. We don't treat them after the crisis is over. But we also don't treat them when they're in the middle of the crisis. So people like my son are cycling in and out of hospital stays. They're cycling short-term, 2 or 3 days, which is very ineffective. They're cycling in and out of jail. My kid's never been in jail, but a lot of people are in this predicament. And then they're cycling on and off the streets. And that's got its own societal costs that we're all paying. So if we, instead of doing that, if we were providing for longer-term hospital stays where people actually could get stabilized on a treatment plan, and then when they're released, we wrap them with services, with medication monitoring, with a place to live, with somebody who helps them get to their therapy appointments, who helps them apply for disability if they qualify, and helps them jump through all the hoops that are needed to stay on it, who helps them get a job and talks to their employer and explains what their particular situation is and maybe acts as a liaison if they're having a bad day at work, you know, can explain, well, this is what's happening, as opposed to the person just losing their job because they're acting strange. So those are the kind of services that would actually move the needle. And I believe that the money's already there. These hospital stays are very expensive. A lot of people are on Medicaid, and Medicaid is paying for these short-term stays that include ambulance rides and police involvement. And jail is a very expensive alternative. And the people who run the jails do not want to be the number one providers of mental health services in our state, but they are. And everybody knows that's wrong. Everybody knows that isn't working and it isn't the right thing to be doing. But nobody's got the ability to change the system. So people of good minds and good hearts are doing the best they can, but we have to really blow up the system. And the governor has a task force that he's put together that is working on a big fix for this. And I've been down there testifying on my particular situation, but also working on a plan with some other people in Boulder, a woman named Phoebe Norton, who used to run the mental health center in Boulder, and another woman named Roxanne Balin, who was the chief judge in Boulder for many years. And we're working on a big fix, a big way to realign the funding and streamline it and give local jurisdictions more control over how they manage their mentally ill population. And we presented that to the task force too. So I'm on the board of Mental Health Colorado, which is an advocacy organization for mental illness here in Colorado. And I'm also on the board of the National Alliance for Mental Illness and in Boulder and Broomfield counties, and also the state National Alliance for Mental Illness advocacy group. And there's a lot of good work happening. And there are a lot of people working on it. And so I feel optimistic that we can make some big changes.
And that's, in a way, for me, Judy, about awareness that we need to continue to move mental health from the shadows, that there's a stigma with that. You fall, break your leg, or someone is born with a physical disability, we don't think of that person any less, okay? And we accommodate. So we have ramps coming up onto the curbs, onto a sidewalk, for example, to accommodate people in wheelchairs, okay? But there's still this lingering, to me, impression of people that have a mental illness that are dealing with it. And we all do in some way. We all go through crises in our life, you know, and things crash and burn for us. We get depressed. But sometimes it's just, I have a good friend who every day has to wake up and face the day, you know, dealing with that anxiety. And, you know, and he's got his meds to keep him balanced and so forth. And I always have to step back and say, hey, you know, here. But it is, to me, it's awareness, but also it's like how we take care of our bodies. If you want to be fit, you exercise. Well, that's preventive medicine. They're preventive practices. Well, you know, and interventions too. You know, if you see someone's just being a sluggard, you encourage him or her to get moving somehow. Okay. Intervene early with people that are in crisis. At a very early age.
Yeah. And we are starting to do a better job of that. There were some things that got passed in the last year that address putting more mental health resources in the schools And that's a big one. It's something we should be doing, and we should do more of. There should also be screening. Like, we test people's eyes and their ears, little kids. We should also be testing, you know, are you a potentially at risk for developing a mental illness? So I think there are a lot of things we could be doing. And when kids get a little bit older, too, there's some red flags. And we're not necessarily responsive to that. And I know, as a parent, I feel incredibly... I blame myself for my son's condition, because I think, well, maybe there were some things that I should have done when he was younger. I should have recognized that there were things that were going wrong. I should have taken more action. And certainly, I feel that way. I know a lot of other mothers do. And society also feels that way about us. So the stigma is on our children, but it's also on the parents. And like, when we have one of these horrific incidents with somebody being violent, you often hear, well, where were the parents? Why didn't they do anything? But the fact is that it's hard for us to take any action, because there aren't the supports in place for the action to get taken.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, you know, I'll go back to the physical. If something, the child falls and breaks a leg, well, okay, I see that. So I'm going to get him right to her, you know, and get that taken care of.
Right.
We don't always pick up, though, because they're so good. And by the fifth grade, kids become a master at concealment.
Yes.
They have figured it out. And you mentioned earlier about a reference to vision and so on, and how something like being colorblind or having astigmatism or something like that, something that causes the child not to be able to read, they have dyslexia, and if it's not diagnosed early, then they start to feel there's something wrong with them intrinsically rather than just a physical thing. And I've had people come on and talk about that. And once you straighten it, you know, and give them, oh, maybe you just need eyeglasses. You give them eyeglasses, you get them comfortable. And all of a sudden, they're in a whole different universe. They start to feel better about themselves. Because when we start feeling lousy about ourselves, it has a descending, we start to spiral down even more.
Yes.
It keeps drawing us into this vortex of, and eventually is depression, and then we start to act out.
Yeah, I don't think we've done nearly enough research into the causes of mental illness, and we don't have a lot of good treatment options, and it's hard. It is hard to get somebody to stick with a medication or to try a series of medications. So you try one thing and it doesn't work,
right,
and then you have to try another thing, and people lose patience with that. And so I think these are all part of why it's hard, but just because it's hard doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it. And I think we will make a lot of progress as a society when we decide we are actually going to address these. We're going to provide the kind of treatment that it is actually effective to solve these problems. And I also think people are kind of ready. There's a lot of vitriol being directed towards homeless people right now. And I think there's an understanding generally that we haven't done a good job of getting at the underlying causes. And if you're fed up with homeless people, if you're scared in your neighborhood, if you feel like you can't go to the park, you know, that's not unreasonable of you. But there's no solution out there except for to try to address the underlying causes. So income, mental illness, you know, drug addiction, there's a lot of causes, and we can tackle these things if we decide we want to.
Yeah, I come with the philosophy that people don't choose to do bad stuff, you know, intentionally for the most part. You know, there are underlying reasons. Now, that still doesn't mean, you know, we need to be accountable for our actions, no question about that. But, you know, I use that spiraling down, that when things go wrong, start to fall apart, and you don't give them the support, then things keep falling apart, and then it becomes, you know, I'm not worthy, and and that leads into other.
Yeah. Well, when somebody's cycling in and out of short, they call them M1 holds, mental health holds. So you have a medical history, And if you're showing somebody's been in the hospital 3 times, 4 times, 5 times in a year on these short-term holds, then we should get a clue. These short-term holds aren't effective. They're not the treatment that you need. And wouldn't you be better off providing more robust services to this person so that when they get out of the short-term hold, they get passed over to somebody who can help manage their medications, who can help find them housing if they don't have housing. I mean, they're just, it's crazy what we're doing.
Well, and I think in large part what we're doing now, just having a conversation, people are out there on the radio listening and learning, and it may also trigger something. It was like, wow, I hadn't thought about my friend or, you know, my sister, yada, 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 and start to look into it more deeply. And it's an awareness. It's a consciousness. It's kind of like the climate change thing, too,
yep.
And how everything is interrelated. You can't just do one thing.
Yep.
That their life is complex.
Yep.
It's not simple, and complexity will not be solved with a simple solution.
Yeah. Well, I also think we should be doing robust public service messaging around addiction and around mental health, because we are vilifying people for mm-hmm. things that are an illness. And public service messaging works. I mean, Smokey the Bear, that was effective. Littering, there was the whole campaign against littering. And people don't litter like they used to. So I think that's effective, and I think we should be putting some money into doing that.
I don't. And I hear you. All right, we have a few minutes left, and I want to just kind of shift here a little bit, because there's this one big issue, and it's probably about 30 miles long that starts at the eastern border of Clear Creek, right around Floyd Hill, and it ends right around the Eisenhower-Johnson tunnels, and it's called I-70. And you're probably getting an earful up here about that. And so what you're thinking, what are you learning, and just your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I have gotten an earful, and I welcome anybody who has any ideas about what they would like to see happen to fix that. I'm all ears. I did meet with Amy Saxon, who is in the transportation department
right.
for Clear Creek, and she really gave me a lot of history and insight about how long this problem's been going on, how many people, how many hours have been dedicated to working on solving the problem, and yet nothing's happening, and that's super frustrating. And of course, we need to address it. It's a climate issue. It's pollution. It's people's day-to-day lives. It is also crippling our ability to get out and do the things that Coloradans love to do, because you can't access the ski areas on the weekends. And so I think it absolutely has to be addressed. I think we need transit along I-70, that whether that takes the form of rail or buses or trams or... What was it you
needed? The Advanced Guideway System,
the
AGS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the elevated rail, basically.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get going on getting the funding for these things and figuring out what the funding mechanisms can be and then implementing them. So I think there's a long-term vision about what has to happen, and then there's some short-term things we should be doing. So the bus staying routes are effective. People like to take that bus, but there aren't enough of them. And it doesn't pay for itself. So I think we have to engage the business community around helping to fund more of that, and so that we can have more of these buses, and we have to make the services really robust. So if you get picked up in Golden, if you leave your car at the parking lot in Golden, then they take you right to the particular ski area that you're going to, or to, you know, the base of Grays and Torreys if you're going to go do some 14ers in the summer. And that is a short-term thing that could happen pretty quickly. Like, we could have more buses next year if we really put our minds to that. And it would begin to work on the problem. I think the traction law, I heard about that and I thought, how big a problem is that? I got an earful from people here that this traction
yes.
law is really meaningful
yes.
and is going to make a difference. And so that seems like a pretty small thing that has the potential to really make a difference. So I think there's some other ideas like that. And, you know, the the toll lanes on the shoulder, you know, not the perfect answer, but it does begin to move the needle a little bit. And it doesn't cost a bunch of money to do it. And so I'm glad they're putting it in both directions. And but, you know, we have Tabor. We have no money for big transportation projects in our state. So that's another area where we really need to do some work to educate people about what do your transportation dollars pay for and where does the money come from if you repeatedly say you don't want to spend more or pay more for transportation. So I was really sad that ballot measure CC didn't pass because that would have provided some money. It wouldn't have solved the problem, but it would have provided some money. But I am involved in a group called Vision 2020, and they are going to put something on the ballot in 2020 to address Tabor. And they haven't decided what exactly yet. They have a bunch of different ideas about ballot measures that they might run. It is going to be a grassroots effort, not a referred ballot measure from the legislature, but a signature gathering effort. And they'll be starting in January to figure out what exactly is it, and then to pull petitions and get people to start signing on to work on that effort.
Yeah, so many things. And you mentioned CC, and by it going down, it has a direct impact on Clear Creek because that's how the improvement on Floyd Hill, which critically must be done. Floyd Hill could be brutal, deadly even. Okay, with that steep hill and then that big curve at the bottom, and that bridge is, you know, not the safest. It's one of those endangered bridges in Colorado, so you need to, I encourage you to focus on that as well. I'm only going to, Judy, take exception with one thing you say about Bustang not paying for itself. You know, dollars and cents is probably right, that statement there. But if we don't measure by dollars and cents.
I totally agree. I didn't mean to.
And I was going to ask you.
I was saying, let's figure out some more funding mechanisms so we can get more buses. And I really think that the people who have the biggest stake in this, the business community in these mountain communities, the recreation economy, they should help. They should want to help fund these solutions.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it'd be better for them. And they'll make more money.
They'll make more money.
Yeah. You get more people coming up and having a meal at Bojo's or wherever it might be.
And they have a better experience, and then they're more likely to want to come back. So I really think there's some partnership there that could happen that would benefit the citizens of Clear Creek, but would also provide a benefit to the business owners who are also making a profit off of access to their areas.
Oh, man, we can go on and on, huh? There's so much here to, and we're just scratching the surface here on issues as to, but we want to get to know you, though. And I really appreciate you coming here, you know, taking some time to visit with us here in Clear Creek. And, you know, you got a lot of territory to cover. You got to get over to Grand. You got to get up to Jackson. It's a pretty big district geographically. And so for you to take the time, you know, here to...
Yeah, this is a big district geographically. And when I first started running, I thought, oh, gosh, that's a lot. But now that I've been doing it, I really have an appreciation for how important it is for me to show up in all of these communities and to hear people and learn what they are concerned about, because the issues here are different from the issues in Boulder, from the issues in Jackson. And I actually think every district should have some urban and some rural and some mountain and some plain, because it makes you a better legislator if you have to consider all of these different things when you're down at the Capitol making decisions for everybody in the whole state. So I'm actually really glad, and it's been an incredibly great experience to be learning so much about so many different communities.
I love it. Okay. People want to get a hold of you, check out your website. You probably want to spell your name completely out.
Okay. So it's judyamabile.com, and that's JudyAmaB like boy, ILE.com.
JudyAmabile.com. I love it. Okay. And you'll be back more. And we have the caucuses coming up in March. right? And yes. So you want to be talking, you know, to the Democrats at that point. You're running as a Democrat,
yes,
in order to get support, you know, for the to get onto the ballot in one way or the other. And then, yep, if necessary, you go all the way to the primary, which is at the end of June.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. So, the caucuses are on March 7th, which is Saturday. And then there's the county assembly, and then there's a special House district assembly because this district has more than one county.
Yeah.
So lots of fun to be had if you want to be a delegate.
Oh, I remember the days way back when Claire Levy was running when she first Okay, I've been around updating myself here.
Well, she's done an amazing job in everything she's done, and she's now running unopposed for county commissioner in Boulder.
Yay.
We're really all enthusiastic about having her as one of our next county.
We've been so blessed and so fortunate. We've had Claire and now Casey, and then potentially you. We'll see. So
yeah.
We'll do. But we'll have you come on back on again, and we'll talk about these and other issues as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
You got it. All right, hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9. Been visiting here with Judy Amabile and her run for the state legislature. We're going to be taking a time out, and we'll be right back.